I hope you all enjoyed your trip to the White House last week. Good. I'm glad to hear it. Tonight we have White House correspondent David Nitkin of the Baltimore Sun. And he's going to talk to us about his coverage. And also, I've asked him to start off by talking about his earlier assignments and how his earlier assignments have fed into his work at the White House. Because as we found so far, most of the people that we have talked to and the ones who are on the archive that you've watched have come to the White House after they have been at another area, whether it's on the Hill or covering the bureaucracy or doing editing. So the White House is rarely the first stop for people. It is simply one of many stops. And so David worked at the state level. And so, David, welcome.
Well, thank you. Hi, everybody. Hi, my name is David Nitkin. I'm a Baltimore Sun reporter, and I've been at the White House for over a year now, so I'm entering my second year. It's an interesting time to start coverage of an administration, you know, covering it in the second term and really sort of in a lame duck portion of the presidency is not necessarily ideal, not the most exciting time. As you see in the media right now, a lot of attention is turning to who the successor is going to be to this president. And the president has even made jokes about that, hasn't he? About, well, those of you who are here, you guys are the ones who are stuck with me, and you're not the ones who are out on the campaign trail. But I've been with the Baltimore Sun since 1999 at this point, and I have, in my career as a journalist, I've covered local government, villages in New York along
the
Hudson River.
Where'd you get started?
Yeah, I got started at my first newspaper job was with Gannett Newspapers. It's now called the Journal News. At the time, it was called Gannett Westchester Rockland. So it was Westchester County, just north of New York City.
Was that out of college?
It was. It was right out of college. What I did was I went to Dartmouth and I got a liberal arts I got a government degree, but it was a liberal arts college, and I was somewhat involved in newspapers, but not super involved, not the editor of the paper. I found that people who get really involved in newspapering in college, if you're the editor of the paper or a managing editor, those are the people who kind of get snatched by the bigger papers, and I came to it late, and I worked my way in through a fellowship at a place called the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. It's in St. Petersburg, Florida. It's the family that it was founded by the family that were the original owners of the St. Petersburg Times, which is a terrific newspaper. If any of you ever go down to Florida and have a chance to check out the St. Petersburg Times, it's got a terrific reputation. And I got into a fellowship program that was news writing and editing for liberal arts graduates, and it was basically like a 8-week immersion course in journalism. And out of that, you know, there are cycles in the economy. I was coming out of that at a time when the economy was pretty good and there were newspaper jobs to be had, and I got hired at in Westchester County, New York, and I started covering a couple of small villages, and then I covered the City Hall in Mount Vernon, New York, which was it was a terrific place. Mount Vernon is this tiny 4-square-mile city right on the edge of the Bronx. It's got a railroad running through it in a cut, and there's literally a right side of the tracks and a wrong side of the tracks, and it had everything you could ever want to cover in terms of urban poverty, racial issues, a democratic machine that just controlled things, and that's what I did. I did 4 years there, got a public policy degree, went to Florida for newspapers.
Where did you get your public policy
degree? I went
to
the Kennedy School. I went to Harvard. Got a 2-year master in public policy degree. Went down to Florida because after my initial training in Florida, I realized it was a terrific place to be a journalist. Number one, as you guys are probably aware, like any crazy story that happens in the U.S. is always happening, either as a Florida angle or just wild stuff happening in Florida. I now on my desk I have CNN on all day and MSNBC, and you know whenever you see the helicopter shots of police shootings or anything, it's always in Florida. Just a lot of weird people there. And the other great thing about Florida, which you learn as a journalist is terrific, is the open records laws. The access to public information in Florida is fantastic. They have these great laws on the books that are the results of a reform era in the mid to late 70s, sort of a post-Watergate era. What I would do when I was I was the Broward County government reporter. And Broward County is where Fort Lauderdale is. It's a huge urban county, and I was able to go in to the county commissioner's office, which those are the people who ran. There was no mayor or strong mayor. It was a council form of government. I was able to go in to their offices when they weren't there, go into their desks and read the mail that was in their inbox on their desks, because that in the state of Florida was considered a public record.
Really?
So when you talk about sort of the differences of different types of coverage in different places and covering, say, the White House, for example,
I think he would be lifted up and carried out.
My goodness, and so we're here in the White House these days talking about these millions of missing emails, and I remember it was right after I left Florida when the votes were being recounted in the 2000 presidential election. I remember Catherine Harris was the Secretary of State of Florida and then was a congresswoman, and she ran for Senate, and she failed miserably in that Senate run. She sort of Peter principled up to her own level, but there was a point where there was a story, and you may not remember it, but if I describe it, it might sound familiar, where and this was a St. Petersburg Times reporter wrote this story that during the recount, Catherine Harris considered herself a Joan of Arc figure. She had told people she was like Joan of Arc at the vanguard of this vote counting operation, and that story got a lot of attention at the time. And the reason that story came out is because the St. Petersburg Times asked for Catherine Harris's emails and got them like the next day, and you were able to see all the dialogue going on. So one of the things that you learn when you're a journalist and you work in different places is you realize that the laws and the norms that are available to you are very different in different places. So when I came to Maryland, in Annapolis, in the State House, the public information laws the public records laws are terrible in Maryland. Things that they just don't release anything. And here in the federal government, I find the laws to be really bad also. I mean, we make requests all the time. If you make a request for information from on the White House beat, you don't do it as much because it's not as much of an investigative beat. But if we do ask for emails, or if you ask for records,
but you can't FOIA the White House.
If you ask for records from a federal agency, they can take years to come sometimes, literally years. So that is one of the key differences of covering a local beat or a state beat and the federal government is the different access to information you have. But those are the places I've worked. I've worked in New York, Florida, Maryland for a bunch of years, and now I'm here in the White House.
You have covered. You spent a lot of time on executive positions where you've been.
Right.
And what are the differences you find in covering a mayor, a governor, and a president? What are the similarities, what threads do you find that carry through, and what things are very different?
Well, I think the similarities are that people who rise to executive level positions, A, have a lot of confidence in their abilities and care oftentimes how they're portrayed in the media. That's one thing I've found from the president to the governor to a mayor. You would think that these elected officials who put themselves out there for voter approval and who have to make difficult decisions and are in the public eye every day, you would think that they develop pretty thick skins. But what's really remarkable to me at all levels, from even from the White House all the way down,
right,
is the degree to which they really don't have thick skins, and things get to them. So mm-hmm. that when we're at news conferences and say, Mark Silva of the Chicago Tribune will ask, Mr. President, you seem a little down today. Are you? Why is it that you're not your usual energetic self? Is because you lost on this particular issue? And you could tell that these certain questions.
Oh yeah, he said putting me on the couch. You're putting me on the couch.
Yeah, he doesn't like this president doesn't like to be psychoanalyzed. but it annoys him a little bit. And I've found that as a similarity among all leaders in executive branches. The difference is, I would say the differences are more that. Well, first of all, in most other executive branches or executive levels, if you're a mayor or a governor, the positions tend to be a little bit more. They try to remove partisanship to a larger degree because they're more. Get things done, rubber meets the road positions. Governors uh-huh. are the types of people that have to make sure the roads get paved. Mayors have to, hire the police chief and run the police department and make sure the streets get plowed when there's a snowstorm. And, that's a famous political dictum. There's no Republican yeah. or Democratic way to plow the streets. In the White House, I find, to a remarkable degree, even when we're listening to the spokespeople speak, things that should just be strict policy mm-hmm. decisions become very partisan. An mm-hmm. example of that is the current debate over FISA, the wiretapping, foreign intelligence security court. When things aren't going the way of the White House, they say. Their latest line of argument is, it's the Democrats in Congress and their trial lawyer friends who are holding things up. I find the partisanship much greater at the federal level uh-huh. and especially in this White House than I have at other levels of government. The other difference really is it's more the size, and this is a theme we can get back to if you want to talk about it or if the class wants to discuss it. If you're the Baltimore Sun covering the mayor of Baltimore or the city of Baltimore, that's the pinnacle. And the TV stations in the Baltimore area, Channel 11, WBAL, the BAL radio station, everybody picks up the Baltimore Sun and uses right. that as uh-huh. this is what's going on in Baltimore today.
Right.
And TV bases its stories on what's in the Baltimore Sun. The same is true in Annapolis. The Baltimore Sun is the preeminent news gatherer for the state capitol. Here in Washington, in the White House, it's very different. 30, 40 years ago, the Baltimore Sun was one of three newspapers that was read in the White House. Now we're at a very different level. We're just sort of one of a whole group of mid-market newspapers. So,
let me break in on that.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Adam Clymer. When he met with some students many years ago when he was at the Baltimore Sun, and he was talking about how difficult it is to get anybody to read the Sun in the White House, since it's not a Washington paper.
Right.
And so he had to go to a lot of, to some extent, to get some articles that he was working on the wire so that they'd be read. By people in different
right.
places. And somebody else was telling me much later that that sometimes they would give people in the White House a story so that they would know what they were doing.
Right.
But now, with the internet, they actually know what you're doing.
Right.
And they have read your stuff. So
right.
in some ways, you're better off.
I think that's true. But I find that but not only are they reading our stuff with the internet, they're also
yeah.
reading Politico.com, and they're looking
right.
at a lot of different blogs. They're looking at the Huffington Post. I think the separation, the expansion, the I'm groping for the right word here, but you know, the breaking into pieces of the news media has had a tremendous effect. I try to use it to my advantage. I think that when I have found in my reporting that when the people you're writing about are hanging on every word that you write and trying to figure out why you chose this adjective and not that adjective, or why you quoted that person first and not this person first, that becomes a very time-consuming thing. You can spend your whole day sort of back and forth with press people or with your sources, or, you know, arguing over words and quotes and tone. In a way, you know, this is putting a positive spin on it. In a way, it's a little more liberating that's not happening right now. I mean, I don't get, you know, the angry phone call at 8:30 in the morning that says, "I can't believe that, you know, that bull that you wrote yesterday," because it's just, I think they have other things to worry about, and it's not rising to that level. So in a way, it's liberating. But you know, the negative is when they are sort of hanging on every word, you feel a little more part of the process and a little more, you know, influential, if you will. Not that being influential is necessarily the goal. What you approach journalism as is trying to illuminate people, shine a spotlight on areas that you think that spotlight needs to be shown, and you know, telling people things they didn't know. So we try to do that, and doing it you know, in Washington, doing it in the White House for the readers of the Baltimore Sun is an increasingly difficult challenge, because it's not clear, you know, newspapers are declining in circulation. It's hard to tell these days what people want, what readers want, what they're really interested in. You know, the owners of all these newspapers say, well, let's, you know, whatever it takes to get revenue up and to get circulation, we'll do. So the owner who bought the Tribune Company, the guy by the name of Sam Zell, says when he's doing his tour of all the papers that are owned by Tribune, and the Baltimore Sun is a Tribune Company paper, meaning the papers in our group are the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Newsday, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, York, Pennsylvania, and a couple other smaller papers. You know, he's going to Orlando saying, like, you know, yeah, let's put the puppy stories on the front page of the newspaper. If people want to read about puppies, let's give them puppies. You know, I think we have to, the challenge for us covering the White House is to tell people why they need to care about the U.S. attorney scandal, why they need to care about FISA, why they should be interested in the Annapolis Peace Conference that was held a couple months ago. And it's an ever-present challenge, and one that we really haven't quite gotten our arms around yet.
Do you find that there are different sets of readers for your website as opposed to the newspaper? Because the situation that newspapers seem to be in is that your circulation is down, but your readership is up.
Right.
And because you're getting so many more people
right.
wanting to read it for free on the web.
Right.
So who do you aim towards? Do you aim towards some of those people on the web, or is it the people that are they're paying for it?
Well, hopefully there's I don't think we think about that all that much when we're sitting and writing stories. I think where we do think about that is the way the job has changed in the newspaper business is not only do I have to write a daily story out of the White House about what's going on, but I also have to think about contributing to various blogs that we have, writing internet only versions of stories. And so So the workflow has changed to get things on the internet, to get them up in different forms, and yes, probably for a different audience. I mean, one measure is when we're posting to a blog, and the one that I contribute to is called The Swamp. It's run by it's run out of the Chicago Tribune, but it gets a ton of hits. It's our political. It's the Tribune's political blog called The Swamp. You know, you get a pretty good barometer of it's actually interesting. It's an interesting question because on the website you can see what are the most viewed and most emailed stories. So you can see when you've touched a nerve. You go on the Baltimore Sun website, the most viewed and emailed stories are almost always Ravens or Orioles. It's that seems to be our franchise is sports, and very rarely is it a national story or a story out of the White House. But on the blogs, like on the Swamp, you see things, you see the comments that get posted. So you know when you've when you've touched a nerve or you've hit upon an interesting topic, when, you know, one posting will have three comments, but another one will have 30 comments. And then if the Drudge Report picks up your item and links to it, well then, you know, all bets are off, and it's you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of hits, and all types of comments. I had that experience last year when we wrote a story. A colleague and I, a colleague at the paper was looking through some genealogy records, and he discovered that Obama's white ancestors, so his mother's great-great-great-grandfather, owned slaves. And people had not known that at the time. And we explored it. We traced the genealogy. We explained who it was. They actually had some ties to Maryland, this slave-holding family. And we wrote the story. Now, we didn't write it as any kind of gotcha piece. We didn't write it as a way to criticize Obama or criticize anybody. But it got hugely picked up on Drudge and others, and then the feedback was absolutely unbelievable. So it's these days, with the way the internet works, you can really tell when you touch a nerve or you hit something that people are interested in.
And within the paper, how was that viewed?
Mixed, I would have to say. It ran on the front page, and after some debate. But I did hear from some colleagues who felt and some black colleagues who felt that it wasn't really an appropriate topic for a story. This was coming at a time when a lot of the discussion was, is Obama black enough? And that debate has sort of gone away after his wins in South Carolina. And I mean, at that time, I think his support in the black community was you know, something like 25 or 30%, and now it's in these primaries, most recent ones, it's like 80%. Right. So the debate has totally shifted. So it was viewed mixed. I mean, some people absolutely felt, and I had discussions with them, that it was not, you know, an appropriate topic for a story, that it really wasn't worth writing about. But in general, you know, if they decide to put it on the front page, that's an indication that the highest levels of the paper think it's a worthwhile story and worth pursuing.
When you're doing your work at, say, any of these any of the levels, whether you're doing it in Mount Vernon or in Maryland, Florida, or here, how do you see your relationship with the public? Is it similar?
Well, I would say that there's been a trend in the past 5, 6, 7 years that we really try to be much more aware of and responsive to the public, but because of the scandals that have that have rocked the media industry, the Jason Blair scandal at the New York Times, people fabricating stories, fabricating sources, and the general level of distrust of newspapers and other forms of media that's really accelerated over the past few years. And so what I have noticed is a trend where we need to explain our decisions, respond to emails quicker, because there's a general feeling in the media that part of the way to improve and restore our credibility is to be more transparent and to communicate more with the public. I will say that when you cover, if you go to City Hall, if you guys ever get stuck in a City Hall meeting or a Zoning Board of Appeals meeting, these sort of local levels of democracy, one of the great things about at a city or a county level, at the local level, is you get these gadflies. You get people who pay really close attention to the process, who are reading every bill, who are giving the mayor a hard time at every turn, who are getting up to speak on every issue that's on the agenda. When you get to the state level, there's some of them, but a lot fewer. And then when you get to the federal, when you get to Washington, you know, those people tend to be crazy or nuts. I mean, first of all, it's impossible to pay attention to every issue at the federal level. And anybody who's really sort of paying attention to everything that the president says or does or wants to comment on it is going to get, you know, targeted by Secret Service pretty quickly. Like, you can't be a gadfly to the president as well. It just doesn't work that way. So that's one of the differences. I think the further you get from the local level, the more a little bit more detached you get from the people, and people are sort of interacting less with their government. And it's a whole, and I think it's why people don't like Washington. It's part of one of the fundamental problems of sort of inside the Beltway versus outside the Beltway.
So do you see yourself then as a surrogate for the public?
I do, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, I do. I see myself as oftentimes in my soapbox moments, I say what my job is to ask the questions that people would ask if they had the time and the energy and the inclination to be paying attention. I mean, that's our job. The definition of media is like we are transporting information from one to the other. Now the president has a bully pulpit, so anytime he makes a speech or issues a proclamation or decides that he wants television time or holds a press conference, he's going to use us as media and get his message out through us. And hopefully it works the other way too, that we're asking questions that people, you know, would be asking if they, like I said, if they had the time and the energy to pay attention. So yes, that I do feel that is very much a part of the job.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what it was like to cover? Well, let's get you to the Sun. How did you get to the Sun, and then how did you get to covering Governor Ehrlich?
Yeah, I was in the State House in Florida, in Tallahassee, for the Fort Lauderdale and Orlando newspapers, and I grew up in Massachusetts, and I was more fond of the Northeast than I was of the South, and I just wanted to try to get, you know, further back north. At the time I came to the Sun, I came in 99, and it had just been ranked in American Journalism Review as one of the top 10 papers in the country. At the time it had an editor by the name of John Carroll, who went on to become the editor of the Los Angeles Times, and a managing editor by the name of Bill Marimo, who had won two Pulitzer Prizes, had come out. They both together came out of the Philadelphia Inquirer at its heyday under a guy by the name of Gene Roberts, who went on to become editor of the New York Times and a really revered newspaperman. So these were two disciples of Gene Roberts who spent years at the Philadelphia Inquirer and then came to the Baltimore Sun and had made it, you know, just a terrific newspaper. So it really was. It was, you know, for young people in their career, it was a place to get to at that in the late 1990s. I knew someone who had left my paper in Fort Lauderdale and had gone to the Baltimore Sun. And after a period of time, I contacted her. It was, you know, networking, the way these things work. And I said, you know, do you know what's going on? Are you guys hiring? And she said, well, you know, send your clips, which is how it works in newspapers. You send your work, your samples of your stories. And she showed them around, and they liked it. And they flew me in, and they offered me a job that day, which was really terrific. But I went from covering the state capitol in Florida, covering Tallahassee when Jeb Bush was governor, to the job they had available was actually, you know, right across the street from you guys, was covering Baltimore County government. And I wasn't all that thrilled with that. I thought that was a bit of a step back, going from covering, you know, the state capital, right, in the fourth biggest state in the country, to covering county government. But, you know, I knew the people who had the job before. They sold me on the thing that the Baltimore County is the largest readership area for the Baltimore Sun. And plus, I knew I had to learn the area. I had to learn Maryland. I had to learn the politicians. Right. When I started covering Baltimore County government, Dutch Ruppersberger was a Baltimore County executive. He was thinking about running for governor at that point. He ultimately didn't, but now he's a congressman, and we still interact as congressmen. There was a state senator in the Baltimore, in the Towson area by the name of Andy Harris, who now may also be an ex-congressman. He just defeated Wayne Gilchrist, the Eastern Shore Republican, in a primary just a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, the connections were, you know, the experience was really good. So. So I came and did well enough that, you know, they knew I was interested in state government. They knew I was interested in Washington. I mean, that was one of the reasons also to get to the Baltimore Sun, is because they had now it's significantly smaller, but they have a large Washington bureau. We're a different type of paper. You know, other papers our size, or even larger papers like you know, the Dallas Morning News or the Houston Chronicle or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the Denver Post, or mid-sized cities have a much smaller Washington presence than we do, because we're 35 miles down the road, and a lot of our readers, I live in Howard County, so there's any number of families in Howard County that, you know, one person goes to Baltimore to work, the other goes down to D.C. to work. It's a company town, and people see people care about federal worker issues. The Social Security Administration is right off of Security Boulevard. The NSA is near Fort Meade in Anne Arundel County. There's all types of reasons why the Baltimore Sun needs to cover Washington aggressively. Right. FDA, we cover all these agencies pretty aggressively. So. I spent about 18 months in Baltimore County, then went to Annapolis. Annapolis is just a terrific place. I'm sure you guys have all been there, and it's historic, it's fun. Coming out of Florida and going to Annapolis, I was amazed that I could walk into the House Speaker's office and just sit down in his chair like this chair and just kind of shoot the bull with him, or with the Senate President, or even the governor for that matter. That's another very different thing between covering the White House versus covering another level of government. When you cover a mayor or a governor or even a congressional delegation, you have just regular access to the people all the time, and you can talk to them. For a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, there's virtually no access to the president. You know, he makes himself available at news at press conferences. I don't get called on those press conferences because I'm in the fourth row, and the questions get to the first row, second row, third, and then they stop. And so it's a totally different type of coverage. We have to analyze the issues. We have to pick the issues that we think are important to our readers. But it is not the type of coverage as here's what he told us exclusively today, and here's how it affects you.
Can you tell us something about the battle that you got in when you were covering Annapolis with the governor?
Yeah. Well, you know, Governor Ehrlich, I covered Governor Ehrlich's election in 2002, and at the time, you know, there hadn't been a Republican governor in decades. I guess it was probably McKeldin that was the last one. No, Spiro Agnew, Agnew was the last one. And so I got to know him pretty well. And he, as a Republican in a state that's majority Democrat, he really had a different way of approaching things, and he wanted to do, one of his ways of approaching issues was he really wanted to marginalize the newspaper. He did not like the Baltimore Sun, and still doesn't like the Baltimore Sun, and he was very upset, I know for a fact, when we didn't endorse him for governor. The race, if you recall, was in 2002, was Bob Ehrlich versus Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who had been Paris Glendening's lieutenant governor. And Paris Glendening left office very unpopular. His poll ratings were terrible for all types of reasons, including that he divorced his second wife and had an affair with a much younger aide, and then had a baby with her and married her when she was pregnant. It was a whole
soap opera.
Yeah, it was. It was a soap opera. And Kathleen Kennedy Townsend was considered this woman who was just sort of playing on the family name, on the Kennedy name, mm-hmm. who had very little skills, who wouldn't be where she was if her maiden name wasn't Kennedy, and who couldn't speak. I mean, she had this famous incident during the Ravens playoff run when she was down for, I guess it was a Super Bowl down in, I think it was in Miami, the 2000. Super Bowl 2001, whatever year it was, and they asked her what her favorite moment of the game was, and she says, "Well, you know, when they, I loved it when the other team went scored that football, and then we got the ball back and we went down the field and we scored a football." I mean, she just couldn't she couldn't speak. She fumbled her words all the time. So she was a very weak candidate in a very unpopular administration, and it was the first post 9/11 election, and Governor Ehrlich won. And so it was pretty clear he was going to go to war against the Baltimore Sun for a lot of reasons. We didn't endorse him. He was very there's a whole Republican mindset that talk radio is much more AM talk radio is a much more effective means of communication than the print media, which, you know, we are considered by our critics to be liberal, you know, the liberal mainstream media. And so he had a mindset that he didn't like the paper. I began writing a series of articles when I found out some details about a real estate land deal that was not very good. It was kind of crooked, kind of shady. He didn't like the articles, but he never disputed any facts in them. One unfortunate day, one of those articles ran with a map that was wrong. He had taken office during a time of fiscal distress, and one of his ways he was going to solve the budget crisis was to sell a lot of state property, including some surplus parkland. And this land deal that I was writing about kind of fit into this broader scheme of getting rid of a lot of state property. And the bigger theme was, you know, is he going to help his buddies? Is he going to help these political patrons by dumping state parkland at a fire sale prices? And we ran a map on the front page of the Baltimore Sun that purported to show all the land that they had designated as surplus, but in fact it showed every acre of parkland in the state. So the map sort of showed shading of like being virtually a third of the state. And it was wrong. It was absolutely incorrect. But he used that as an excuse to say he sent out, his press office sent out an email that said, from now on I ban all... nobody in state government can talk to David Nitkin, and they also added in Michael Olesker, who was a columnist mm-hmm. for the Baltimore Sun at the time. They didn't like him for other reasons. So they put the two of us in there. And the editors of the paper took it very seriously. They decided this was a violation of the paper's First Amendment rights. They decided, after negotiations failed, and I'll tell you this, just as an aside, the editor of the paper, who's still the editor, his name is Tim Franklin, got on the phone with the governor's press secretary that day, the day he issued the ban. The guy's name was Greg Massoni, and said, "Yeah, we know the map is wrong, but is there anything wrong in David's story? You know, you're banning him. What's wrong with the story? David didn't produce the map, which I didn't. I didn't even know it was going to run. I had nothing to do with the preparation of the map. I didn't know that it was in the planning stages. I didn't provide them with the information from the map. The Sun's graphic department's made a map, put it on the front page." The editor of the paper said to the governor's press secretary, "We understand about the map. We're going to correct it. We'll run a correction. What's wrong with the story? You banned this guy." And the press secretary said, "Well, I didn't read the story." Mm-hmm. So they sent out an edict banning everybody in state government from talking to me, and they hadn't read the story. Turns out everything in the story was right, it was correct, and I feel vindicated because in the 2004 election, as a result of all these stories, they put the lawmakers decided that they needed to amend the Constitution. There was a constitutional amendment was put on that says the governor cannot sell parkland without the approval of the General Assembly, and that passed by like, you know, nine to one, you know, 90% mm-hmm. margin. So because of the deal that the governor was pursuing that I exposed, the Constitution was amended to prohibit further deals than that. But the paper took this ban very seriously, rather, in hindsight, the better approach probably would have been to say, all right, well, you know, we now have 2-3 people in Annapolis. The Baltimore Sun's going to put, we're going to double that. We're going to have 6 people in Annapolis, and we're just going to, you know, you don't like the coverage you're getting, wait till you see what hits you next, and, you know, cover it more aggressively. We pursued a lawsuit. We lost. The courts did not want to deal with this issue. They felt it was a political issue that they didn't want to get in the middle of. And so we lost in court. The governor lost at the ballot box in his reelection.
Yeah.
But the ban was never lifted. And to this day, he really won't talk to me. He's taken it all very, very personally.
Uh-huh.
He and his aides.
But people in state government can talk to you.
I guess because there's a change of administrations, it's kind of moot at this point. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And the current governor O'Malley does talk to me.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
How did you feel about all of that? Did you feel like you wanted to get out to do other kinds of stories, that it was just too contentious?
No, I didn't. I felt that I was doing my job. I felt that,
yeah.
You know, as a reporter, you always feel funny when your sources or the people you're writing about come up to you and say, you know, geez, I really like that story that you did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you kind of want to be... I've always thought, as a journalist, you want to be respected. When they see you coming, you know, they want to be a little afraid about what you're going to ask them and what you're working on. So I feel that as a journalist, the goal is to be respected and feared a little bit. So the scrutiny was really high. Every word I was writing, as I mentioned earlier, you know, people parsing over, or people scouring every adjective, whether you seem to be biased by calling someone, you know, disgruntled rather than perturbed, or, you know, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So I that got a little tedious, sort of like this
uh-huh.
This scrutiny over every word. But in terms of the you know, saying, well, this is it, I don't need this anymore. No, I never felt that way. I wanted to keep going. I felt I was doing my job.
Did you find that there were a whole new bunch of people who were willing to talk to you?
Yes, some. There were some new people who were willing to talk to me. There were others who I had built. Basically, what happened was the people who I had built relationships with in the past, who knew my work,
uh-huh.
who knew me rather than just as the name, but who had dealt with me on a professional level, knew what I was like as a journalist, and were willing to deal with me and
uh-huh.
still talk to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, but you know, what we did was we. You know, I would write a story, and then when we would need a comment from the governor, we would ask another reporter to call the governor's office to get some sort of comment. So I kind of did all the work I needed to do, and then we turned it over.
Mm-hmm.
We turned it over to someone else to make that like final phone call to get the governor's comments. But
how do you go about getting information in from this White House?
Yeah.
That any White House is more difficult because you can't just walk in and talk
right.
to people.
Right. It's hard. I find myself doing much more, many more pieces that are more analysis stories, or people commenting on the reason behind the decisions. You know, either people who were in the White House and then left, or people who had been in previous White Houses. I find that that's more of the types of stories that I'm writing these days, rather than the, you know, sort of the facts that came from the ground up through the White House that led to that decision. I find myself with much less access to that type of information, and I think most journalists,
yeah.
you know, sort of in at my level, my type of paper, I would guess that there are certain reporters with the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or CNN who have more access to, well, here's a, you know, off the record or on background, we will
mm-hmm.
tell you this is what led to our decision on this. Now, those types of stories, you know why the president decided this at a certain time, it's a little constraining for the Baltimore Sun because we don't seem to be very, the papers and readers, our readers, aren't all, doesn't seem to be all that interested in those types of stories about, you know, like how decisions were made in the White House or how they gathered their information and then made those decisions. So I find myself getting a sort of reaction or analysis from other people in other White mm-hmm. Houses. I find myself getting, there's a lot to write about, there's a lot of data out there on the federal level on various issues. So when the paper decides to me, they say, listen, we'd like you to focus on health care for a while. We'd like you to focus on Medicaid, Medicare, or Homeland Security. You know, there's a lot of data that's generated by the agencies themselves and by you know, interest groups that you know, you can look for trends. But in terms of getting the information out of the White House itself, that's kind of not the way I'm going about my job these days.
Uh-huh. Do you find that the Hill is very useful in covering the White House using the Hill?
Yes, I do, and I wish I had more experience covering the Hill. The predecessor in my job, her name is Julie Davis, and she had been our Capitol Hill person before she was the White House. She kind of reluctantly became the White House person when another person left. David Green, he's on NPR right now, so you might hear him if you're ever driving around listening to. And you know,
yeah.
David Green,
yes, right?
Right?
Yeah.
So he was with the Sun as the White House person. He left to go to NPR, and then they asked our congressional person to cover the White House, mm-hmm. and she was not happy about that. She had a lot of Hill connections, and they served her very well. So I know for a fact that it is valuable. I don't have that same kind of background, those same level of connections, but people are much more willing to talk. It's a much more open environment. So, yes, having that experience, I think anybody who's been in Washington would tell you that that is valuable to come mm-hmm. to the White House.
Can you tell us what sources of information that you use? Like, say, we've talked to White House people, to Dana Perino and Tony Fratto about their days, and Emily and Carlton.
Yeah.
And you kind of when everybody starts and
right.
when they, what they read. When do you start and what do you read?
Oh, that's a good question. I start my day, I get up, you know, anywhere between 5:40 and a little later if I'm sleeping in. I get delivered at home, I get the New York Times and the Baltimore Sun. So I'll read those in the morning over my first cup of coffee. I'll take a run, and I'll get the Washington Post when I get on the train to come in. So by the uh-huh. time I've gotten to my desk, I've read three newspapers. I've read the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Washington Post. When I get at my desk, what I do is I check the Associated Press wire to see what has broken. And then I'll go through my whole series of bookmarks that I have of various websites. So
what websites?
I do like the Drudge Report. I like to see what is getting the most attention. I read ABC's The Note. I read Hotline. I read the Huffington Post. I go to I look, the Washington Post has a bunch of online things that they don't mm-hmm. have in their print edition, so I'll go to The Fix, which is Chris Calise's political blog. Frumkin does White
right.
House Watch, which doesn't
right.
appear in print, so I'll read that. What I'll do is we have access, which is really valuable. Here's another thing about Washington, which I didn't realize until I got here, and it's for reporters. It's almost like a cheat sheet. It's kind of like a dirty secret, I think. But like everything the president says is recorded and transcribed, and anything that almost anybody else sort of notable says is transcribed by someone else. So we have access to a service which is a federal transcript service. If you log on in the morning, you see what everybody said on the late night talk shows, and then congressional hearings, appearances on cable news and elsewhere are all on these transcripts. So I'll read through the transcripts to see what is out there and what is being said. I've also got Google Alerts set up for for Bush and Hillary Clinton and Obama and McCain and other items. So that fills my inbox pretty regularly. And then, you know, we're getting deluged by press releases from not only the White House, but, you know, Speaker Pelosi and John Boehner and Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell and the chairs of committees. So there's no shortage of I mean, the bureau chief Paul West, who's my boss, says, you know, covering Washington is like it's like trying to drink from a fire hose because the information is just so voluminous. And I actually have a lot of respect for Dana Perino and Tony Ferrato to be able to sort of have a level, now not, you know, maybe not a very deep level, but a certain level of mastery of a level of familiarity at least with just about any topic that's presented to them on any on any given day. I mean, if you sit through, you guys went to a briefing, an off-the-record briefing last week, but have they watched or seen or read the transcripts?
Yeah, a lot of them
White
have,
House,
sure.
White House briefings.
Yeah.
So you'll see that on any given day, there's, you know, how many topics would you say? You know, 12 topics, 15?
Yeah, right.
And some of them are they're very specific about, you know, what a particular foreign head of state said, you know, the day before or you know.
Or might even have been earlier in the day.
Yeah.
And which can be tough to
keep up
with something
so
quick.
That's right. So any, you know, on any given day, Dan will say, well, I saw that as I was coming in here, and she'll still give a pretty competent, you know, two or three sentence, you know, something that's at least usable if someone's writing on that. So it is drinking. You know, Washington is like drinking from a fire hose, and you just gotta kind of pick your spots and see what you're most interested in, and try to figure out what the readers are most interested in.
Well, let's go to some questions. So you all have some questions?
Please do. I'm going to blow my nose, excuse me.
I live in Rockland County. I was just wondering how you liked writing for the Journal News.
I liked it. I was really young. You know, it was my first job, so I thought I was like king of the world, and in hindsight, I didn't really know what I was doing a lot of times. But you know, it's an interesting, it's, as you know, it's the suburbs, right? So it's like, you know, not the same level of excitement as New York City and not the same level of excitement as Washington. Rockland County is just over the river from Westchester County. It's on the other side of the Hudson River. So you've driven you go over the Tappan Zee Bridge a few times, right? And but I enjoyed it. It was a paper that was trying to, at the time, compete with papers in New York City and sort of figure out what it wanted to be, and we weren't doing it very well. So, like, when I was there, we started the paper started a Bronx edition in a tabloid format, and I was working in Yonkers, and the Mount Vernon edition I was working for went to a tabloid format because we thought we were going to compete against the New York Post and the Daily News, and that didn't work out. So it's become this paper that's just sort of like, you know, just for those suburban communities, White Plains, Nyack, Ossining, you know, places like that. And so it's a bit of a mishmash. I don't think, you know, looking back and looking at it now, because I go there a lot. My wife is from White Plains. I was just there last weekend, so I get on the website every now and then, and I know a lot of the reporters still there. I don't think they do terribly good journalism, and so I don't think they fill either niche all that well. I don't think you can find out a lot about what's going on in Rockland County by reading it, and I don't think you can find a lot of what's going on in sort of the greater New York region by reading it. What do you think of it? Do you read the paper? Do you get it, or does your family get it?
I played sports in high school.
Okay.
So I used to read all the time.
Right, and so that's one of the big things about local newspapers. Is like we try to get people's name in the paper all the time. So like high school sports is a big thing that local newspapers like to do. So was your name in the paper a lot of times? Do you have all types of clips from your name being there as athlete of the week or something?
And pictures and It was big on sports, the Journal News.
Yeah.
Somebody was saying that that the president reads the Dallas Morning News, and so somebody was commenting that one of the things, reasons he read it, because he liked to follow the sports in it.
Well, you know, and I saw. I'm a Red Sox fan, and last week the Reds, we were there together. The Red Sox were at the White House, and the president's comments. I mean, they were so sort of impassioned and detailed at his level of knowledge. Now, obviously, the speechwriters, you know, helped them put them together, but he clearly was. Had a tremendous, maybe you and I even talked about this, he had a tremendous level of interest in the personalities and the individual accomplishments or tales of Red Sox players, and sometimes he doesn't have about other issues. I mean,
he's always been interested in ball players, and so you notice that often when there's a funeral and they have presenting a group, they'll often have a ball player on it.
Right.
And Joe Torre was put on a board the other day that dealt with cancer.
Ah.
And Joe Torre was put on that. So.
And for us, Cal Ripken was just named like some international sports.
Yes,
ambassador.
That's right.
So,
that's
so,
right.
So Ripken's,
and we've gone to China.
Very big,
that's true.
Deal.
Yeah.
So who? Let me just show of hands. Does anybody get a newspaper, like an actual paper edition of the newspaper? Either have a subscription or buy it maybe more than once a week. Two. And what's that?
Got a few on the side.
So. Oh, okay.
Okay.
What papers? What papers do you guys read?
Washington Post, Baltimore Sun.
Fraser News Post.
Yeah, good.
Sometimes.
And do you find that you, the people who get papers, how do you compare getting a paper and reading it to going online and looking at the website? Go ahead.
I think it's easier to read it online. So I think it's more confusing to read it online personally.
Do you find that you read articles in the newspaper that you would not read online? That online it's more targeting to what you're looking for going into it, whereas, like, say, if you're reading the New York Times, you might read a whimsical piece if you're if you just have the newspaper in front of you that that deals with something that's just far away from what you're normally interested in. That by going through the paper, you see more and read more.
Yeah, because online, it's just, all you see is the front page, like the top stories. When you have it in your hand, you can flip through, and it's just more accessible. You can read more of the smaller stories that might be more interesting to certain people.
Yeah, I would second that, like, online, when you're looking at it, you see the front page, and then, let's say you're interested, you want to see sports updates and, I don't know, like, something on the environment, and you can just click on those two things, and you only see the stories for that. But if you're looking through the paper, you're kind of forced to see other things, especially stuff that you wouldn't otherwise read.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, of the people who don't get newspapers, how many people would you say your primary source of information is television? Television news, either national or local. Just one? And how many?
There's a second one there. But there might be on the wings there.
Right. And how about internet? Yeah.
How much time would you guess that, estimate that you would spend a day looking at things on the internet? News stories on the internet.
About an hour.
A few hours or so.
That's a lot. And do you do it many times during the day? Like, if you were reading the Washington Post, would you read it, look at it several times a day if you're online?
Well, a lot of home pages, like my home page is Comcast, and they'll have a lot of not usually little news updates, but usually big news updates, and they'll keep posting updates. So every time I go onto the internet and pull up the page, it'll keep loading. I guess it's the wires or whatever, but they keep loading new information.
Yeah.
So every time you go online, you get a little bit more.
Yeah. Is there a sense that your paper, and I guess with the Tribune altogether, that there is a way to make money when circulation is lost and readership is up?
That's a big question.
How to do it?
I don't know. You know, that's whoever can figure that out is gonna save the newspaper industry.
Well, one hopeful note. I was doing a piece on Eisenhower and television, and I went back to look at the connections of how presidents had used it as it began.
Yeah.
And so in the 1940s, I came across an NBC executive who was talking about the difficulty of figuring out how they were going to make money. And so he said, I can't imagine that people are actually going to look at ads.
Right.
And that they would look at ads on television. And so I don't know how we're going to make money. And so I was thinking that here, looking
right.
back, it's very easy for us looking back to see how they were going
right.
to make money. And I wonder if maybe that's true with any technology that's new.
I think it
and
is.
There'll be
it,
some way
yes.
that's right now is difficult to see.
What I also think about that, I have a couple observations about that. What I also think is probably when television, you know, came on like gangbusters, people in the radio industry were probably very nervous and thought, you know, well,
yeah.
maybe this is the end of us, you know,
yeah.
You know, television will crowd out radio. But yet here we are, you know, 60, 70 years later, and radio is still around,
yeah.
you know, doing different things, but still a functioning industry. And you hope that I hope that newspapers are the same way. A couple of weeks ago, I was on the road with covering some of the presidential candidates, and when I came back, the paper said, well, you know, we liked what you did, and we want to make sure we give you this kind of cool little digital video camera that we're giving to a lot of the reporters. They had bought dozens of them, so that next time you go out on the road, you can shoot little video images of people you're interviewing and, you know, send the video back to us, and we can put little clips. And I thought, well, that's terrific. That's really fun
mm-hmm.
and neat, and I'll enjoy doing that. And then what dawned on me a couple of weeks ago was that as I watch these clips, and on a lot of news websites this happens, when you click on a video clip on a news website, you have to watch a little 15-second commercial first for
uh-huh.
for something. So I'm guessing,
uh-huh.
I have to think that part of the reason... Yes, the technology is available, and they want to do it, and it's good to disseminate information that way, but they're also looking to make money off that by basically selling commercials on on these little video clips. I was on, you know, I was watching some Onion News, which is that, you know, the comedy, the fake news website, and yeah, the, you know, Old Spice body wash was you have to watch a 15-second ad for Old Spice body wash for every Onion clip that you want to watch, and we're doing the same thing. We have the, you know, so that's we're going to make money that way, but hopefully it'll replace circulation enough to keep us in business. People who don't subscribe to newspapers, and do you, if someone could answer this, do you find yourself interested enough in news that you go to news websites to follow, or do you have to do it for a particular class, a political science class, or any other class? I mean, is news something you feel you want to stay on top of, or do you feel you're more forced to do it or compelled to do it? I'd like to hear somebody's answer to that.
I mean, I check the internet a lot, and I feel like I'm kind of addicted to it. I always want to know what's happening.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And what kinds of things do you look at?
Mostly wire services.
Uh-huh, but
you know,
it's news.
Way,
it's news that you're looking at. Uh-huh.
Yeah, like whatever the wire services are reporting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it's local. Global, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Some others?
If it's the wires, yeah. I don't know. I feel like the wires, they have to get the information out so quick that it's just cut and dry facts, whereas the stories tend to be a little more, I guess, tainted a little bit is the only word I can find. They seem to have like a bias in them. I guess it's just either that's it's the product of the reporting or the reporter, but I feel like the wires, they just get the facts out there. So if it's a wire story, yeah, I'll sit there and read like for hours. Huh.
That's interesting. I mean, we hear that a lot, and I try to argue, or my position is always that what we're doing is, when we're writing a more full story than a wire version, is adding context, adding analysis, challenging some of the assumptions, reaching out to different sources, and that is giving a sort of a fuller picture than you get from just a wire story. That you're right, they're because of their deadline pressure, they have to get it out so quickly. And in my own mind, I wonder if that perception is actually accurate, or sort of the function of what media critics have been saying for so long, that it has become part of the drumbeat. And maybe both are true. But I, you know, my wife, for example, she's, you know, people are always asking me, you know, who do you like for president, or who are you going to support? And she, you know, and people are asking her too, you know, when she's out sort of during the day, you know, well, who does David like? Who does he think's going to win? And she always, she said to me just a couple of weeks ago, she says, what I've realized is, like, you don't even want to make that decision yourself or have your own opinion. And I really don't. I mean, I feel like I want to gather facts. I want to get as close to the truth as I can get on any given story. I want to show why something that somebody's saying may be true, may not be true. But I really studiously try, and almost every good journalist I know tries hard to really eliminate, wipe out their own opinions from news articles. Now, is that successful? You know, possibly not. But you know, it's a problem for our industry that people feel that they can't trust what they're mm-hmm. reading.
Don't you think, in part, it comes from, say, in Washington, the very strong kinds of partisanship that there is, so that when you're quoting people, you're quoting people that have very strong and harsh views. And so it is seen as, well, that's just, you know, the same old Washington, and that's, but it's not the reporter that's doing it. It is, whether it's Harry Reid or
right.
or Pelosi or Bush, it's
right.
all of them, you know, right. whacking one another.
I do. I agree with that. And I also think that another problem with the news business and media is that what tends to make news is conflict and not mm-hmm. sort of everybody coming together and singing Kumbaya. And so there's a school of thought that you know, there was a rage or a movement a couple of years ago called civic journalism, where newspapers and journalism was going to head in a direction where it was going to be an institution for helping solve problems. So that if you have a, you know, if it's a crime in Towson, you know, at the town center, or traffic in the Circle, you know, we use the newspaper as a vehicle to bring people together, discuss, hash out the issue, reach consensus, talk about what needs to be done. It's called civic journalism, and it kind of was a fad, and it didn't go very far. But really, if you're sitting down to prepare a news report, it's the conflict makes news more often than not, and that the quotes from one side or another that you're going to use those outrageous quotes stand out, and so that mm-hmm. kind of it does contribute to the problem. It fits mm-hmm. in with what you're saying, is that not only is Washington polarized, but then the most polarizing comments, the most outrageous comments, are the ones that get more play. They get picked up more.
When you're putting together a story, a White House story, Tell us what some of the elements of that story would be.
Sure. What we try to do is have, you know, fresh sources. Try to get the most fresh, being, you know, you don't want to use the same people talking, mm-hmm. you know, over and over, because there are experts out there, and there's any, you know, on any day you could call Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia or Hess at Brookings, mm-hmm. and, you know, so there's a sense that you want to make sure you reach out to a variety of sources. Want to make sure that the White House fully has a chance to have its say, you know, and they almost always do, you know, and if they don't address it in a public setting or the briefing, I find them fairly responsive in terms of, you know, getting either Dana on the phone or these days exchanging emails, you know, saying, mm-hmm. listen, I'm working on this, can you give me your position, or do I have this right? And Fratto, Dana Perino, Scott Stanzel, they're all pretty good about responding either by telephone or email, I find. Mm-hmm. I find the level of cooperation pretty good. Getting the opposing view, and for me, more often than not, what I'm doing is trying to look for something that other people haven't written about. So I have the luxury. One of the good things about my job is I have the luxury of a lot of times taking more than a day or two on a story. I can take 3 or 4 days, and if I'm writing on something about the environment or homeland security, I can really look for the definitive experts and the definitive data to illuminate that story. So I don't have to be like,
like a wire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Mark Miller on CBS Radio, who has to, if the president says something in the morning, that I have to turn around and write about that for within just a couple hours and really distill it down. I have a luxury. The good part about my job is that I have the luxury of saying no to a lot of things, and the things I say yes to, maybe spending a day or two more so I can really get definitive data on it.
Uh huh. He has to go back and write on the story of tonight, which are the primaries, the Texas and Ohio primaries. So let's take one more question.
Sure.
What kind of relationships do you
have with your editor? The relationships with editors have to be really good working relationships that have a lot of good give and take and are built on respect and trust. And so I have good relationships with there's any number of layers of editors. I should say, before I took this job, before I came to the White House, I was an editor. I spent about a year as the state editor for the Baltimore Sun, so I oversaw our 2006 election coverage, which was the O'Malley-Ehrlich election. So that gave me a whole level of understanding of getting stories in the paper and what makes a good news story. And the interactions. So because of that, I think I'm a better reporter, and I think I'm a better communicator with my editors. I communicate on a daily basis with the bureau chief who's in Washington, and then above him it gets up to, you know, deputy managing editor. The further along you get in the business, the more they leave you alone and they trust your judgment. So I don't have to be, you know, handled a lot. But in terms of sort of talking through story assignments, what we're going to cover, it's a very collegial give-and-take relationship that is not a lot of frustration. So I try to keep those relationships good. Well, thanks. I wish I could spend the last 15 minutes, but like Martha said, I do have to go and see how the primaries are going tonight, and I appreciate your time. Thanks
Thank
a
you,
lot.
David. Enjoyed it very much.